This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning.
Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice of San Diego, joined as always by Sarah Libby, Managing Editor. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Andrew Keats is taking the week off. What a week to take off. Obviously, we've been thinking about and talking about what happened at the Capitol in D.C. this week. Unfortunately, San Diego played a role in it, as it always seems to do in the biggest national stories. Congressman Daryl Issa indulged the conspiracy theories that drove the mob to attack the Capitol before telling everyone he wants us to come together. Police also confirmed that the woman who died in the insurrection, the mob, what you want to call it, was an Ocean Beach resident. Just here, right here. And we're going to talk about what she was swimming in as far as ideas. Then there's Mayor Kevin Faulkner, who picked maybe the worst timing ever to endorse President Trump. And we've got a lot to catch up on in the state and local level, too. Since our last podcast, Assemblywoman Shirley Weber was appointed Secretary of State. That happened. Feels like 100 years ago. Governor Gavin Newsom set that in motion after picking Alex Padilla for the U.S. Senate seat. And now there's a swirl of local political possibilities. We're going to talk about those. And then on the second half of the show, we're going to talk about domestic violence, City Attorney Mara Elliott, and a wild story about fertility fraud. We've got it all. This show is going to grapple with a lot of heavy things, guys. Sarah, can we do it without Andy?
Oh, we can do it. Better without.
Right? When did you realize things were going off the rails yesterday?
So, like most people, I assume my group texts were going off yesterday, and my friends in D.C. Were going to pick up their children early from school because they were worried about their kids' safety and worried about the safety of the Black daycare workers there and them being able to get home. And we hear so much about politicians saying like, oh, D.C. isn't real America. And there are people who live in D.C. and are real people who have real lives and real safety concerns. And like hearing them airing those felt very real and urgent to me.
Yeah. I think the moment it became clear something real was happening is that picture came over Twitter, I saw it, of those guys scaling that wall.
Yeah.
And that one was just like, oh my God, what is happening? And then I couldn't look away. It was just, it was such a surreal moment in this experience we're having, this pandemic. My kids were home, obviously from school, running around and screaming and having fun. My dogs were fighting, and this thing is happening, playing out in real time. And I'm trying to think about local politics and stuff. It was just an incredible moment, and it's still very difficult to process.
Yeah, if you've been in that building or covered it before, it's very hard to process. I mean, Capitol Police might accost you like three blocks from the Capitol to keep that area safe. And they certainly, you know, control dress codes and what women are wearing. And, you know, it's not like a lenient atmosphere. And so to see people do what they did so easily was really, really jarring.
Yeah. And I totally agree with everybody who's been making this point that, like, obviously, if it was, you know, radical religious Muslims that were there, they would not have let that happen. If it was Black Lives Matter protesters, they would not have let that happen. Now, I don't think they looked at the people there and said like, oh, we'll let those in. I think they just, it was a bias in preparation, right? It was like they started saying like, oh, I don't have to worry about this group And that is where the bias played out. And not necessarily, and then all of a sudden they're like, oh my God, we're surprised. And not necessarily, and I don't know exactly what the decision making was. Maybe there was something more sinister, but not necessarily upon seeing them, they made a different decision.
I think it was almost certainly both. I mean, seeing them being so deferential in the actual Capitol itself and saying, stay within the ropes. I mean, they were seeing those people with their eyes and making that decision in real time. In addition to the obvious preparation, it was a much different preparation than other protests and demonstrations.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, several members of San Diego's congressional delegation were evacuated. Representative Sarah Jacobs, she was the first of the group. This was like 3 days into her term. She's the first that came out and said that she both encouraged Vice President Pence to invoke the 25th Amendment, but also requested the House of Representatives, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, to pursue impeachment today. As we're recording this Thursday, Pelosi announced that she will pursue impeachment and has asked Vice President Pence to pursue that 25th Amendment. Now, to be clear, the 25th Amendment says you can remove the president from office if the majority of the cabinet and vice president say he can't do the job anymore. Then the Congress has 3 weeks to affirm that, but obviously he'd be gone within 3 weeks. Do not know how those will play out, but Jacobs was later joined by Scott Peters, who represents the 52nd district, and by Mike Levin, who represents the 49th. And then there was Daryl Issa, Sarah.
Yeah.
Daryl Issa, who I think for the last year has demonstrated a preternatural ability to leverage hate for his own political advantage, had made a decision that he was going to embrace the conspiracy theory that the election was stolen and that the vote in Arizona in particular to start needed to be challenged and thrown out. So he was one of the, 130 or so House Republicans who voted to throw out the results in Arizona, the Biden electors, and then he voted again for the vote to be thrown out from Pennsylvania. And then late in the night, he said, and I couldn't pass this up, he said, our nation deserves far better. This is the time to give our all, honor our institutions, and uphold our American democracy. I don't know, Sarah. Feels like he's not all in on that.
A lot of honor for the institutions in voting to overturn an election.
I think there's this cynical version of what's happening where he and others are like trying to take advantage or trying to jump aboard this this feeling that a lot of people have that this vote was stolen. And I think that what is so dangerous about what he's doing is whether he believes that or not, and this like rhetoric, well, we can still come together. If you indulge the version of what he has indulged, this conspiracy theory that all of these races in these different states were stolen, and Daryl Issa believes that and voted for that. If you indulge that, then you are indulging what they did to the Capitol. Because how can you live in a republic if that's what you believe happened? And if they truly believe that, you can see why they did what they did.
Yeah, I think a lot of being a Republican nowadays is like this exercise in trying to have it both ways and trying to appeal to the people who support Trump and all of the theories and, you know, actions that they are taking part in, and also, you know, this other faction of the Republican Party that rejects a lot of that. And we've seen that from a lot of Republicans locally and nationally, that they're trying to walk this tightrope and kind of indulge both sides. And it's really hard to do because they're at such odds.
Yeah, and they're not only at odds, they are fundamentally conflicting. You're like, and Mitch McConnell took the position yesterday that, okay, this is over. The courts have reviewed this. The recounts have reviewed this. This election is over and we have no role in changing that. And then there's the other side where it has been stolen by this incredible conspiracy involving national and international actors that they can't provide a single bit of evidence for. And you can't indulge both sides. You can't have it both ways. Which brings us to two other local angles. One of those is another person who endorsed Daryl Issa at the height, by the way, of his like nastiest version when he was running for Congress. And that's Kevin Faulkner, former mayor of San Diego, who decides, what was it, 2 weeks ago or so?
It's hard to say, given that time has no meaning.
Yeah. Decides that's the time to reveal that he, in fact, is a big supporter of Donald Trump, the president. Kevin Faulkner, who said he would never support Donald Trump, who took pains for 4 years to parse every word he said about the national government to never imply that he actually did support the president.
But also not to rule out that he didn't.
Yeah. There was that famous meeting that they had at the Oval Office where Trump comes out of it and says, the mayor of San Diego was just here and he was just all over excited and praising me for the wall that we were building. And then Faulkner comes back and says, yeah, I didn't do that. This is the president, by the mayor's own account, lying about what he said. And he's still not willing to say, like, this guy is bad.
And you can even feel this tension of trying to have it both ways in the very statement he made saying he supported him. And he followed that up by saying to the LA Times, you know, I thought he'd be best for the economy, and still trying to separate Trump from all of these other things that he's associated with. And I sure don't believe that the economy had much to do with protesters hanging a noose yesterday or flying the Confederate flag. Don't really believe those to be economic anxieties on display.
No, so quite a moment for the president for the former mayor to endorse the president. Obviously, he's trying to angle for his run for governor, and I think the calculation is very plain. Again, it's this classic Issa or Ted Cruz calculation that you can kind of manage this monster and use it for your own political aspirations without fully indulging it. Like you said, like you can say, like, well, I really liked him as economic principles.
Right.
And so he endorses. So he's obviously trying to put a leg up and get the Trumpy vote for his run for governor. But I just don't think it's going to work if there's somebody more Trumpy that wants to be there.
That's the question.
I guess we'll see, and I guess that's the game that he's playing. And then there's the last version, the woman, Ashley Babbitt, who police confirmed died in the mob attack of the Capitol, was apparently a neighbor of mine in Ocean Beach. And I don't have a lot of insight on this, except that when you look at the things she was saying and promoting, she was heavily influenced by QAnon, the conspiracy theory. I'm not sure how much we want to get into that, but the deep, cancerous conspiracy theory alleging a international conspiracy to rape children, run by everybody from the Supreme Court leaders to the to famous actors. It's like the mega conspiracy theory of conspiracy theories that's turned into a quasi-religion. And again, if it gets to that point where if you believe what she believes, you can see why she would do what she did. And to indulge that, as some of these leaders are doing, is to indulge an insurrection of the American Republic. There's no way to, again, dabble in containing this monster and let it be like, oh, they're blowing off some steam. If you indulge those things, you indulge the belief that, yes, the American government needs to be violently overthrown.
Right. They're taking him literally.
Yeah. And our own former colleague, Will Carlos, who now writes for the USA Today, flew from San Diego to D.C., apparently sitting next to her the whole time.
Yeah.
It's amazing how small the world is. All right, late last month, right before Christmas, and right after we shut down the podcast for a little winter's nap, Governor Gavin Newsom made two big announcements. First, he appointed Secretary of State Alex Padilla to the U.S. Senate seat that Vice President-elect Kamala Harris is leaving. And then he immediately filled that Secretary of State seat with San Diego Assemblywoman Shirley Weber, not Lorena Gonzalez.
Yeah, that was a moment that I screamed at my desk to no one.
It's very rare that we are that surprised about a political development of any kind. I mean, it goes years before you get those kinds of things.
Yeah, it was kind of a rare, like, oh, politics is fun for this, like, 1 second in time. And then, you know, very quickly, as we've discussed, it became soul-crushing again. But there was a real moment there with Padilla and Weber and gaming out who might take her place in the assembly, where things were kind of exciting and fun, and I appreciate that little gift.
Yeah, so Shirley Weber represents the 79th Assembly District, which is southeastern San Diego, but also La Mesa, Lemon Grove, and then South Bay, parts of eastern Chula Vista. It's very similar to Sarah Jacobs District in Congress. It's this sprawling, extremely diverse. There's a lot of wealthy people. There are poor people. There are vast diversity of ethnicities and backgrounds. Now, next door to her is the assembly district that Lorena Gonzalez represents. And Lorena Gonzalez was openly running for Secretary of State. She had been making it clear she wanted to. Didn't she announce it on our podcast? That's right.
She did make it official on the podcast, and she even had like an actual campaign architecture set up really far in advance. I think in advance of even Alex Padilla running for re-election in 2020 or maybe 2018, she has, you know, actual fundraising campaign committees set up. She has, you know, like she's actually running.
She raised like $350,000. She had built a portfolio of bills to sort of build her credibility for the seat, access for younger people to the ballot, the motor voter registration at DMVs. She had really tried to be the legislator for voting, right?
She's the reason you don't have to pay postage to mail in your ballot.
Right.
You know, she's tried to spearhead voter education bills and allowing 17-year-olds to vote. All kinds of voting efforts has been one of, not the only focus of her time in the legislature. Obviously, she's very into labor and women's issues as well, but it's certainly one of like the three cornerstones that she's been invested in.
And then there's Weber, who had never told the governor she wanted the job.
Right.
She's by far, as I said in the politics report I wrote about this, I think the undisputed best speaker on the Hill in Sacramento. I think it's precisely because the things that she drives at the Capitol are the things that she is deeply passionate about. And they are, above all else, two major things. One is criminal justice reform and police use of lethal force and changing how that works. And then equity and quality of education. And the two groups that she fights with the most in those issues, the police union and the teachers union, you know, she's one of very few willing to take both of them on as seriously as she does.
Yeah, it's going to be really interesting. You know, I think she told Cal Matters that she's hopes that she has sort of put into place some pieces and encouraged people in the legislature to kind of take up that mantle. But it's not immediately clear to me who would do it so forcefully. There's another, Southern California Black legislator who's been involved in these issues, Holly Mitchell, who's now on the LA County Board of Supervisors. And so without either of them in the legislature, I'm not sure who that champion would be. There are a few, you know, possibilities, but certainly no one who would be so willing to take on these powerful groups as aggressively as she has.
Yeah. So, just before we move on from this particular point, put into perspective how disappointing this must have been for Lorena Gonzalez. It must have been just devastating.
Yeah, I think as surprised as we all were, it was probably that surprise for her mixed with, you know, extreme disappointment and sorrow.
And she probably had to like really think about what she could say about it, because on the other hand, she's friends and everybody respects Shirley Weber, and you don't want to take away from that moment. And you know, Black woman taking that seat too is such a powerful thing, especially with voting rights access and stuff like that. It's just, it was an incredibly confusing day, I think, for a lot of people.
Yeah, and so I had sort of, I suppose I wasn't surprised necessarily that the governor didn't appoint Lorena, because she is so actively running that oftentimes they don't want to put their finger on the scale for an upcoming election in that way. But if that were the case, you would expect them to appoint someone who is just sort of a very clearly temporary guardian of the role, a caretaker who was going to step aside. And very quickly we learned that Shirley Weber doesn't plan to do that. And so I think that is what makes it so interesting is, one, they were next door neighbors. Their districts are right next to each other, colleagues who, you know, work on similar issues and have similar viewpoints. But one wanted the role and one had no idea.
Yeah, just an extraordinary moment in local politics, which then opened up. We expected if Lorena Gonzalez got the role, we'd see a domino effect of other seats and other political changes. We thought maybe Tony Atkins could get U.S. Senate, which could cause a domino effect of these things. We didn't think that it might happen to Shirley Weber, but it did happen to Shirley Weber, and it is causing a domino effect right now. There are a bunch of people looking at her seat, including her daughter, Dr. Akilah Weber, who, if you follow the Voice San Diego podcast, you heard her this summer when she is a city councilwoman in La Mesa, who came to talk to us about what that night was like in La Mesa when they had to call a curfew and bring in the National Guard, or asked to get in the National Guard and couldn't get them there as La Mesa, parts of La Mesa burned from reaction to a police officer who had manhandled a young man and now been fired and now charged, by the way, this week by the district attorney for lying in his police report about what happened. So Akilah Weber, she is a well-known doctor. She's an obstetrician, OBGYN, who has done like nationally renowned research on different issues. And so at first, I think a lot of people were like, "Which is she, you know, did she want to give up that profession to go and follow in her mother's footsteps and run, you know, a political campaign like that for a state seat?" And she put that to rest right away. She's like, "Yeah, I'm in."
Yeah, I think there had been some speculation that she might run for Congress in the district that Sarah Jacobs ultimately won. And so it does seem like she has been sending signals that she's ready to take the next step in politics.
This is a really interesting seat as well. Again, we pointed out it's so diverse. Now it's seen as like obviously something the Black community wants to protect as representation, but it is such a diverse seat. There are other people considering it. Mark Campanajar, the guy who just lost to Daryl Issa, he made it clear he wants to run. Colin Parent, who's a La Mesa City Councilman as well, he said, "Look, I'm looking at it." I asked him directly. I said, "Look, there's a lot of people who think of this as a seat that a black person needs to represent and should represent, and they need that representation in leadership in the state. Would it be pretty awkward for a white man to take that seat? And he says, yeah, those are fair considerations. I'm going to just have to think about it. And then, I mean, then there's a bunch of other people, Tasha Brown, who's been active in the NAACP, Monica Montgomery, city councilwoman, just ran for city council president. She was mentioned. Genevieve Jones-Wright, who ran for DA. So many different people who might look at this. But we don't even know when exactly the race will be, because it takes a whole domino. The vice president has to leave, become vice president. Then the Senate seat has to be filled. Then the Secretary of State seat needs to be filled. And then the seat will be open and declared vacant, and then they can run that election.
Yeah, I want to back up to, you called Amar Campanajar and he told you he's considering it. And, you know, we gave Kevin Faulkner a hard time for his newfound support of Trump and what that might do in a statewide race. And I think you could ask the same questions of Amar, who certainly had to calibrate his positions given the district he was running in at the time. You know, he spoke with members of Defend East County in a way that made a lot of progressives uncomfortable. He famously said that he supported overturning the gas tax, which was something that the state legislature, you know, his potential Democratic colleagues in the legislature certainly enacted and worked to protect. So I think he would have a lot of explaining to do to this district.
Or would he try to...
positions he took to moderate in a different district.
Yeah, or would he try to embrace that as like, I'm more of a conservative option or something, you know, once you go that route. Now, you mentioned Defend East County. Let's just make clear how polarizing that is. Defend East County was created after those Black Lives Matter protests in June and became really a hotbed of kind of QAnon hate discussion, conspiracy theory discussion. And that guy who is active in it, I believe it's like Jason Haskins, he was just speaking yesterday about what happened at the Capitol and saying it was, you know, a merited overthrow attempt of the United States government. That is the group that Democrats, yeah, and others were frustrated that Amar Campanajar kind of tried to cozy up to.
Right.
So yes, there are a bunch of other people considering the race now. I'm not sure how it'll actually play out. I had heard that there were, you know, people like Genevieve Jones-Wright wouldn't run if Monica Montgomery run, vice versa, that kind of thing. So we'll see how it actually plays out when it's decided who will run. There are other potential candidates, a couple of former Republicans in La Mesa, Christine Alessio and Bill Baber, both left the Republican Party, but they're both city council members in La Mesa. They've been mentioned as people who might consider it. There's a guy in South Bay on a school board there, Eduardo Reyes, who may consider it. Aramique Glass Blake told me she's totally into it, and she had a shot at anyone who would kind of. She says she doesn't want to see someone succeed just because of their name, which seems like a shot at Akilah Weber, who's following in Shirley Weber's seat. So what an incredible week. And we didn't even mention that also that very same day, the president pardoned Duncan Hunter.
Yeah, that happened.
That happened. I wrote the politics report that weekend. I was just like, God, this is just, I didn't even want to write the politics report, but how was I not going to? You know, I think it's really important to remember what he did. The short version is he took money, donated to his campaign, and he lived on it. He used it to subsidize the family that he was neglecting and the escapades that he was neglecting them for. You know, then he threw his wife under the bus for it. And so the pardon to me basically communicates like, yes, you can use that money for yourself. As long as you play for the team in power, and that's the wrong message we want to give politicians, I think
that's fair.
If you want to follow the Politics Report, go to voicesandiego.org, VOSD.org/politics. Okay, we had a couple of stories this week that we wanted to make sure you heard about and saw. In downtown San Diego, there is a place that serves victims of sexual assault, domestic violence, and sex trafficking. It's the San Diego Family Justice Center. When I moved to San Diego in 2003, Casey Gwynn was the city attorney, and it was his pride and joy that he had created this as a kind of one-stop place for people who were suffering within their families. It was very dear to his concerns, but it's not been functioning at the same level during the pandemic. Sarah, explain what Ashley McGlone, the reporter, found.
Yeah, so we've actually been hearing kind of rumblings and complaints about the services at the center since before the pandemic. And some advocates say that the services and offerings there have been suffering since before then. But I think what she was able to confirm and nail down is that this center, like plenty of other agencies and businesses across the country, is no longer open to in-person services. And it's happening at a time when we know that domestic violence and abusive relationships is going up. It's, you know, people are forced to be in the same confined space with their abusers and bad things happen as a result. And so I think a lot of these centers across the state have actually stayed open and have committed to staying open precisely because of that, whereas San Diego's has not. And several people who run centers across the state told Ashley, you know, like, we felt it was very important that we stay open, and we made the necessary adjustments and precautions so that we could do that. And then as she was looking into this, she made another pretty startling finding, I think, which is that the city attorney's office for the last several years has been prosecuting fewer and fewer domestic violence cases. They handle misdemeanor cases in the city of San Diego. The DA's office prosecutes misdemeanors outside of the city and felonies in the city of San Diego. And so the DA's office hasn't been prosecuting fewer cases, and the city attorney's office hasn't had fewer cases referred to it. It's simply prosecuting fewer of those cases. And one of their explanations, which I think is honestly shocking, was a spokesman for Mara Elliott told Ashley that one of the factors has to do with the fact that they believe juries want to see video evidence of these cases and are so accustomed to seeing, you know, videos of crimes take place that actually impacts their decision to prosecute a case. And so, like I said, I thought that was a really shocking admission, that if you are a victim of domestic violence and you don't happen to have video evidence of your assault, that your case might not be prosecuted.
Yeah, that was Mara Elliott's spokeswoman, Hillary Nemchek, who said, based on our office's interviews of trial jurors, it's clear that that is almost required. She said, when a DV report lacks video evidence of the incident, it raises the degree of difficulty in securing a conviction, a factor that we must consider when deciding whether to prosecute in the first place. I'm surprised they even brought that up.
I'm surprised they brought it up. I'm surprised they would say that publicly, even if it is a factor of theirs, which I think is questionable. And, you know, when you're a juror deciding on a case, you're instructed to weigh the evidence that's before you, not the evidence that you wish you could see. And so to be basing, for a prosecutor to be basing their decisions on that desire in juries is kind of unbelievable.
But in essence, though, it is an admission that they're doing fewer prosecutions.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers certainly bear that out. And they might say that at least the most recent numbers could be impacted by the pandemic. But I mean, the numbers make it quite clear that they are prosecuting fewer cases.
All All right, the last story we wanted to make sure you did hear about was another bananas one. This was from our contributor, freelance writer, Jared Whitlock. You guys have been working on this for several weeks. It's about a weird finding that some people were getting from their DNA tests. You get these DNA tests, you send them back in the mail, you come back, and you find out what?
That the fertility doctor treating your family, your mother, is actually your father.
I mean, it was jaw-dropping to read this thing, this one woman's tale where she's like, what? And then he talks to this doctor and the doctor's like, yeah, I don't really have an excuse. I just used my sperm.
Yeah. I mean, he talked to him directly and he said, yeah, I did do that. I'm going to go ahead and call that a lapse in judgment.
Unbelievable. And I thought that the word that the woman used, the victim in this, I don't know how you put it. She called it a medical assault. And I think that was really well put. There's something violent about it.
Yeah. And I was especially touched and troubled by one of the families who, you know, had this situation, their families being treated, fertility treatments, and they knew that they were using a sperm donor. That wasn't, you know, a mystery. What was a mystery is that they were told that it was an anonymous student or someone else, and the fraud was that it was the doctor himself. And they described how the doctor took pains at the time to stop them from looking into or pursuing who the donor might be. And at the time, you know, he gave them reasons for why that might be in their best interest. And then looking back, they think, you know, it was to protect him. And given that it's helpful to know your medical history, if you have certain conditions or just in general, that felt really deceptive to them.
There was another part of that story that was really rough for me, is where the woman, another person who found something similar out about the doctor, realized that she attributed a lot of the distance between her and her father that raised her to the fact that they weren't actually biologically related. And I thought that was just gutting. Like, maybe that helped her with some closure, but that just hurt. I don't know.
Absolutely. She was describing how her father that she grew up with was so proud of her and so, you know, invested in her, and she never necessarily felt this close connection, and she felt guilty about that, and that this helped explain that feeling to her.
All right, all these stories, of course, you can follow at voiceofsandiego.org. Check them out. Big week. I know everybody's dealing with it, and hopefully we can get to the other side of some of these dramas and traumas and such. If you have any ideas that you want to share about what we should be talking about or any stories to do, you can always email me at scott@voiceofsandiego.org, scott@voiceofsandiego.org, and sarah@voiceofsandiego.org. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. Keep up with all of our big stories and the most important San Diego news with the Morning Report. It goes out every weekday, 5 days a week. Subscribe at vosd.org/morning. I'm Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief. Sarah Libby's managing editor. This show is produced by Nate John. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.